Tonight's lecture is called The World is God's Temple, Reading Genesis 1 with Ancient Eyes. And I thought it would be a fun way to start to do a little exercise together. I'm going to show you four pictures, and at some point, if you know what this is a picture of, you can raise your hand. It's four pictures of the same thing. But once you figure out what it is, that's when you can raise your hand. And there's a few people in here I've said I'm going to do this, and they're not allowed to raise their hands at all. So here is picture one. No hands. Oh, we got one hand. All right, picture two. Any guesses? Here's picture three. This picture on the side sort of gives it away. And then picture four. Do people know? Well, okay, I see some hands now. If people aren't familiar, this is, at least according to Google search, this is a picture of our universe. A piece of it.
Our galaxy.
See, there you go, our galaxy. Shows. I know nothing about astronomy. What's that?
If it's our galaxy, who took it?
That's a good. We'll discuss that at the end in the question and answer time. So get your answer ready. But these are all four pictures of how people conceive of the universe. Now I'll start with this one, or conceive of the cosmos, how they see creation. This is an Egyptian picture, and you see Shu, the sky god. This is Shu, the sky god, and he's supporting Nut, the sky goddess, right here, holding him up. And down below is a picture of Geb, who is an earth god. And then this is a more recent picture that's based off of, it's an illustration. It's not an actual ancient picture. It's an illustration of kind of a Babylonian cosmology, how people in Babylon would envision the world, envision the cosmos. This is another one. You can see how it's been engraved in the stone here. This is sort of a drawing of it. There's Babylon, there's other cities, there's swamps, there's oceans. It's a picture of the cosmos, of the world. And then this is evidently a picture of the Milky Way. I was just informed.
Well, it might be the Whirlpool Galaxy.
The Whirlpool Galaxy. It's totally throwing me off now. I need to make a note to work on this PowerPoint presentation. But what I wanted to illustrate with these four pictures is that at different times in history, people have conceived of the world or of the cosmos in very, very different ways. You could use, one scholar talks about this as cosmic geography. And our cosmic geography is always changing. In fact, ours has changed even in the last, since when I was in high school, Pluto was a planet.
Yeah.
And recently Pluto is not a planet, but now there's a satellite, there's this New Horizons going out, and I haven't read much on it. They're maybe reconsidering its planetary status because there's moons around it. I don't know. Anyway, so things are in flux. And so as we consider tonight Genesis 1, which is a story of creation, a story of cosmic origins, a story of the world, what I wanted to do, which I hope this has sort of set me up for in some way, is to show that the way that we perhaps think about the world is not the way other people have always thought about the world. And so my idea is kind of, and this is not my fancy term on the top, my hope is to sort of silhouette the story of Genesis 1 against I'm stealing this term from an ancient Near Eastern scholar, the shared cognitive environment of the ancient Near East. And so if you know the map at all, if you know the history of the people of Israel, of which Genesis 1 is their story of origins, these are all sort of the surrounding nations. You have Babylon, Sumerians, I'm not sure how you pronounce it. You have down here Egypt, you have Edom and Moab. So it's Mesopotamia. It's this whole region of the world that's very, very diverse. It's polytheistic. These different people have different gods. They have different traditions. They speak different languages. There's quite a bit of diversity amongst these cultures that surround and influence the people of Israel. But at the same time, there's something shared cognitively across this environment. And one of the things that is sort of shared is how they tell creation stories. And so that's what I want to do. I want to, like I said, silhouette the story of Genesis 1 against how creation stories are told in other environments to sort of see, my hope is to see how ancient eyes, which was part of my title way back there, how ancient eyes would see or what kind of nuances they would pick up on from Genesis 1 that we missed. Because we come to the text with a very different understanding of what it's talking about, if it's talking about this or maybe some other thing that at least looks like this, than they do. They conceive cosmic geography very differently. And I think this kind of shared cognitive environment, you could think about it, it's somewhat analogous to sort of the idea of the Western world. So think of France and America, we're separated by very different histories, different languages, different culinary histories. One is richer and better than the other. You can decide for yourself. But there are some generally shared ideas about being human, about how we order our economic life, though there's differences, how we order our political life. There's more in common amongst the Western world than, say, North Korea. There's a difference. So I think there's something analogous that we can see in how people in this shared cognitive environment of the ancient Near East would tell creation stories. And I think it's helpful, it's important to do this sort of background work for two reasons that are related to one another. And the first one is that God always accommodates himself in communicating to us about himself or about the world. He tells us, he speaks to us in ways we can understand. So when he spoke to people in the ancient Near East, he did not give them this sort of picture of the world. He gave them a picture of the world that would make sense to them, as these are other sort of images that how they would think about the world. And so this idea of accommodation is encapsulated really well from this reformer named John Calvin. He says this. He says, "For who even of slight intelligence does not understand that as nurses commonly do with infants, God is wont in measure to lisp in speaking to us. Thus, such forms of speaking do not so much express clearly what God is like as accommodate the knowledge of him to our slight capacity. To do this, he must descend far beneath his loftiness." So Calvin has this image of the way that you kind of stand over a crib and coo to a baby. He says the word lisp. I actually delivered this lecture earlier this afternoon to a 5-month-old, and I would often go over and coo. She was listening to me. And so my cooing would communicate to her in a way that makes sense. Lisping to a baby, it communicates something to them. Where if you sort of gave a kind of a, if you say anything else, the words don't make any sense. So Calvin is presenting God as accommodating, communicating to us in ways we can understand in our cultural moment, in our linguistic moment, in our particular worlds. And then the other conviction, which is related to this, is that while the Bible was written for us, as Christians, we look to the Bible, we read the Bible, the Bible was written for us, it wasn't written to us. It was written to a very different culture. There's a large chasm between us and the original hearers or writers of Scripture. And the more we can learn about what life was like back then in this environment, the more we can maybe narrow the chasm. And so when I use the language of ancient eyes, it's sort of that idea of like what people on the other side of the chasm think, or what do they clue in on when they would read something like Genesis 1. And so what I think, and my title gives it away, is that Genesis 1 is telling the story of creation, the story of the world, by telling the story of a temple. That it's making the point that the world is God's sacred space, is a place where he dwells, where he is present, and that the world, the whole world, is God's temple. And so my job is sort of to substantiate this for the rest of the lecture, because if you've read Genesis 1, the word temple doesn't even show up there, even in like the original. So my job is to try to explain why ancient eyes, ancient ears would hear temple allusions. And before I get into it, I'm going to give a few caveats. What would a LaBrie lecture be without a few caveats at the beginning? And the first is that this is not the final word on Genesis 1. It's probably not the last either. People have been writing about Genesis 1 for a long time and will continue to do so. People much smarter and with more insight than you'll get tonight. The next caveat is I'm not going to directly present this to deal with the very contentious ever-present issue of creation versus evolution. I'm happy to talk about that later. But I want to talk more about how Genesis 1 would be heard in its first context and what that would mean to the people that first heard it. And my third caveat, actually I have two more, my third caveat is that none of this is my own findings. This is all from other kind of biblical scholars, ancient Near Eastern scholars, and I just wanted to say their names in the beginning. I'm not going to footnote them or cite them directly, name them throughout the lecture so it's not as cumbersome. But if you're interested in learning more about this, two great people to look for is a guy named John Walton, who teaches at Wheaton College, a guy named Greg Beale, who teaches at Westminster Seminary, and then there's some other people who write about this. John Levinson, who's a Jewish scholar at Harvard, a guy named Gordon Wenham, who I don't know where he teaches anymore, and then a guy named Ian Proven, who's from Vancouver Regent College. And then the final caveat is to say, and we'll sort of touch on this later, but I just wanted to say Genesis 1 is not the full story of the world. It's the beginning story. So it gives us a clue to God's intention, to God's plan for the world, but it doesn't give us a full story of the world. So there's much more to say. The Bible gives a big long book, but we're just going to be talking about the beginning and framing it in this way of the world as God's temple. And I want to do so because I want to ask the question of why this matters. What's at stake in talking about the world as God's temple, the cosmos as God's temple? And a few things come to mind. The first is that there's really no such thing as a neutral description or story of the world. There's no bare facts out there. All descriptions convey value and sort of place priority on certain things. And so it matters which story you choose. There's no just sort of world out there and everyone has, or someone has the sort of unbiased view from nowhere that is the definitive objective take on the world. Everyone's take or story on the world comes from somewhere. And it matters. And one of the reasons why it matters, I think, is conveyed in this quote from, often used quote from I think he's Scottish. Anyway, a philosopher named Alistair MacIntyre, who says, "I can only answer the question, what am I to do, if I can answer the prior question of what story or stories do I find myself a part?" I think it's actually supposed to be a part of. But what he's getting at is that, maybe I'll put it this way. Like, I am often paralyzed when I have to make decisions. Decisions of significance. What's important? What kind of work do I want to do? Who do I want to marry? What do I want to do with my life? These are big questions. And what he's getting at is before you answer questions of what you're supposed to do, you need to realize what kind of stories you're a part of. And this is a very particular story about what the world is about, what the cosmos is. And so, again, we're going to be talking about temples in the ancient Near East, so you're going to have to stick with me as we're going to do some work. It's a little warm in here tonight. But we're going to talk about temples. And so the first thing I want to say about temples in the ancient world is that temples were understood to be a microcosm. So there's really deep connections in the ancient mind, ancient eyes, to use my clever phrase, between understanding the nature of the cosmos and the nature of the temple building. So you could say what you see on a large scale in the rest of the world, you see reproduced on a smaller level within the temple building itself. So it's an architectural, and this is an Egyptian temple that's really in ruins. And the picture after it will sort of elaborate why I've chosen this one to start with, or make clearer at least. But temples were architectural representations of how people in the ancient world thought of the cosmos. So in many ancient Near Eastern creation accounts, so in all sort of the neighboring cultures of Israel, the people that would hear the Genesis account, in all of their accounts of creation, the making or creation of a temple was the culmination of the creation of the whole world. It kind of moved to this point where the temple was the center of the world, and it was a place where a god would come and dwell and rule. And the conceptual association seems to be that to create, a god would need to exercise power or authority. And then after the creating process was done, the temple was the place from which he or she would subsequently exercise this power. And again, this is an Egyptian temple that's totally in ruins. And I'm going to read a longer quote from a prominent Egyptologist. That's how it was described in the book. I didn't know an Egyptologist was a thing until I started doing this, but you too can grow up and be an Egyptologist if you so wish. But he's going to make a quote that's sort of encapsulating this reality of temples as a microcosm is seen just in Egypt. And you can see this in other cultures as well. And he says, "The Egyptian temple is a depiction of the world. The wave-shaped structure of the enclosure wall is a representation of the opposition between dry land and the primeval ocean, or primordial ocean." And so you couldn't really see it in this picture because there's been so much, because the temple is now in ruin. But this is kind of the outer gates of a temple. But you can see how the bricks, if nicely drawn this line, that looks like waves and draws to mind, or is evocative of water. He goes on to say, he speaks about these things that are called pylons, I believe is how you pronounce them.
Yes,
thank you. About pylons, he says, which are these things, these big things in the front here, which are the entryway into the temple. You can see now more of a side view of how they look. But he says the pylon with its two pylon towers and the recess between them with the gateway represents the horizon. So what draws to mind is when you look at this temple, this draws to mind the horizon. It draws to mind the limits of what we can see, the limits of what we know, the limits of the world. It's sort of built into the structure of the actual temple. And then he goes on to say, "The temple building itself is the cosmos. The temple ceiling with its depiction of birds, for instance, is the sky. The bark shrine and the cultic image chamber are identified as the vault of the heavens." And these are a couple of pictures of an interior. These are, it's hard to see, but you can sort of see these are pillars that are holding up the roof, or holding up the ceiling. And there's sort of engraved leaves there. It looks like a tree with the leaves at the top. They're all kind of slightly different. And the trees are sort of supporting and holding up the sky. This is a picture of a tapestry that was, he was talking about bird imagery. This was one that was somewhere on a ceiling. But, I mean, there's a duck on there. I don't really, well, and ducks fly, so. But the idea is that a temple represents the place or the extent over which a deity would rule. It was where they had control. And the same connection between a temple and the nature of the world is seen in Israel as well. There's multiple psalms that talk about this. This is just one of them. And it said, "And he built his sanctuary like the heights, like the earth which he has founded forever." And the heights there are kind of, it just means the sky. So the idea is that God who built both the world and the temple has made them to reflect each other, to look like one another, to resemble one another. The ancient Jewish historian Josephus wrote that every object within the tabernacle and within the temple was intended to recall and represent the nature of the universe. And so I'm going to really briefly talk about Israel's temple itself. There's a really wonderful lecture, kind of goes in a different direction with the temple from Walter Kim that we have here that I just recommend if anyone wants a good lecture to listen to on the nature of the temple. But so there's somewhat of a threefold structure to the temple. There's this outer court area, and then you can see this inner holy place, and then back here is the Holy of Holies. Actually, I have another picture that shows it a little better. This looks like it's from, like, a Nintendo temple video game, which is super fun. And you can just get lost Googling images of this stuff. It's kind of ridiculous. But you
Where's
can
Mario?
See Mario is actually hiding here, and he's going to jump out and bump, and then a little Nintendo joke. but so there's these three sections here, and each one has architectural or it's built in a way that evokes the three parts of the ancient world according to kind of how the ancient people thought about it. And you could say out here, this is the earth, this is the heavens or the sky, and then in here, the Holy of Holies is what's beyond the sky. And there's been a lot of work on this. I mentioned if this at all intrigues you, I mentioned that guy's name, Gregory Beale. He has a very thorough, long, detailed, interesting book on all of this. He really substantiates a lot of this stuff in ways that we couldn't really do justice to tonight. But the way that this outside part represents the earth and the sea, the part of the natural world, is right here. This large basin is actually called the sea, and it is a basin that priests and people would come and wash themselves, ceremonially wash their hands before they would go into the temple. And it's supported by four groups of three bronze bulls, and they sort of represent the four corners of the world that are holding up the primordial seas. And then here is an altar. And the altar is a place where you would bring grains from the earth or animals from the earth and bring them to the Lord. And before the building of the temple, before the temple was in one place, it was sort of traveling about, wandering with the people of Israel. It was called the tabernacle. It's a different thing. But they called this the altar of earth, which is fairly explicit. And then But after it was built in Solomon's temple, Ezekiel actually called it the bosom of the earth. So there's, out here you have images of sea and earth. And as you move into the temple, you also see that there's this, it looks similar to the pillar in the Egyptian temple that we just looked at. But here, it's a pillar that kind of has trees and leaves on it. It's like a palm tree and some leaves on the top. But when you walk inside, prominent within this area here that represents the sky are seven lampstands. You can call them a menorah. They have seven lights on seven lampstands. The number seven is going to come up a few times tonight. But what's very interesting is in the Genesis account, on day four, God creates the sun and the moon. But the word that's used in Genesis 1 is not the word for sun or moon. The word is light. And the only other time, it just means normal light. The only other time that word for light, there's multiple words for light in Hebrew. The only other time that that word, which comes in the fourth day of creation, shows up is when it's speaking about the lights on these menorahs. So you walk in and there's this deep kind of linguistic connection or association between the lights that you see on these menorahs and the lights that you know Genesis 1 said God made and are in the sky. So there's interesting kind of conceptual link right there. And then the last place is this place, the Holy of Holies. And the priest would enter in here one time a year. There's a whole lot you could say about the Holy of Holies. But when the priest would come in, he would literally fill the room with incense so he couldn't see past the incense. And which again, this represents the room that whatever it is that is beyond the visible skies, right? The unseen, whatever is above heaven, whatever behind the clouds, that's what this room, which is as... interestingly, it's a perfect square. We'll come back to that a little bit later. It's as long as it is high and as it is wide. So built within Israel's temple itself, there are these connotations, these reminders. I don't necessarily think every time an Israelite went to the temple, they were reminded that, you know, everything is about the world. Like, but there's deep kind of symbolism and a deep connection in Israel's thinking too, between the temple and the nature of the world. But I do want to say too, the temple wasn't, just briefly, a temple wasn't kind of the ancient Near East equivalent of a church. You didn't just go there to worship. They were the central kind of organizing, unifying institution throughout the cultures of the ancient world, where issues of morality, religion, politics, agriculture, society, economic issues, all sort of intersected at the temple. So the temple was the place people were at regularly. But then, so we got that temples are a microcosm of the world. They're built in some way to represent the nature of the world. The next thing I want to say is that the temple was a place for the god to dwell. It was their home. If there was no deity in the temple, it wasn't a temple. It was just a building. This is a picture of a ziggurat, which is... I probably shouldn't have put that picture up there. It's a little... Well, maybe I'll talk about it in a second. But if you think about the construction of this temple here, Solomon's temple, the way it's recorded in the Book of Kings is it takes 7 years to make, so 7 years to construct, and on the seventh month of the seventh year, it's ready. But they take 7 days of ceremonies to get the temple ready before Yahweh descends in a cloud of smoke into the Holy of Holies, where he takes up residence. And so even when the building was done, it was complete, until God was in the temple, it's not a temple. It's just another building. It's a particular building, but it's not what it's supposed to be. And so this was part of the reason with what... These are ziggurats. These are really interesting, mysterious buildings throughout Mesopotamia. In particular, there's about 30 of them that we know about. And while they look a little bit like a pyramid, there's no inside to them. You just go up them. They're just big stairways. And part of the idea was these were often adjoining temples. And the idea was that the deity would literally descend from beyond the clouds and then come down the stairs of the ziggurat and then come into the adjoining temple. And so there's lots of, like I said, there's 30 of them, and they have names like Temple that Links Heaven and Earth, or Temple of the Stairway to Pure Heaven. So it's very clear what they're for. They're get heaven from earth. I jumped ahead of myself there. But while Israel's story of the temple, like God himself comes down, how other cultures understood that a deity was present in the temple, because that's what they were made for. Temples were made to be homes for gods, was through idols. When I was giving this lecture earlier today to my five-month-old, my five-year-old walked in the room and said, "Dad, why do you have all those pictures of the Incredible Hulk on your computer?" So, I don't see it, but maybe he does. Here's a few more. This idol is made of an image of a Babylonian king. And then this is another guy who's about to hit you with that club. But I'm going to take it back to this picture. So idols are literal material. They have substance. And it was understood that the shape of an idol was designed by the god who it was made to look like. So an idol, in a sense, is really made after the image. It's made to resemble the deity that it stands in place for. And like I said, they were inspired by the deity. So the deity inspired a craftsman or a priest to make an idol to look like the deity himself. And it's sort of hard to get... Well, idols don't just symbolize what the god is, you know, or what the deity is. The idol's job in the temple is to actualize the presence of the deity. So it makes the presence of the deity real. So if there's not an idol in these temples, and there are often multiple idols in the temple, the god wasn't there. And so what would make an idol would be a series of divinations and rituals that were performed on the idol that would include things like washing the idol's mouth. And all this would function to enliven the idol, to kind of make the idol come alive. It would bring it to life. And people understood this idol then to be able to eat, to drink, to communicate. It came alive. And so this idol, which is patterned off of the deity gives the design for the idol to resemble him or her. And then there are these rituals that perform that make it alive. And regularly, in some of the cultures that surrounded Israel, these divinations and rituals were the culmination of seven-day ceremonies. So it would happen over a seven-day period. And at the end of the seven-day period, they would bring one of these idols into the inner chamber, the sanctum of the temple, and then the god would be present in the temple. He would be actualized there. His presence would be there. So where you have a deity, you have the god. But there are some... See, there's a bit of variance. Kings were also considered deity or divine in some sense, so they would make idols of themselves. And then... Put their idols, especially at borders around their kingdom, to kind of again show the area in which they would rule. And this is just an angry idol. These are called the Gudea cylinders, and they're housed in the Louvre. Someone want to pronounce that correctly for me? And they tell the story of, it's a Sumerian account of the creation of the world, which also tells the story of the creation of a god named Ningurusu. And it happens that the creation ends with this seven-day period where the idol is brought into the temple and then manifests Ninguru's presence to the rest of the temple, throughout the temple. And now, so a deity is in a temple, right? Temples were made to house gods. And the temples were made to look like the world, to draw to mind the world. But what's really interesting is when the deity would reside or dwell in the temple, it was often described through images of rest, language of rest. And the rest is not what we think of first when we think of resting, stopping. I know. It's getting a rest. So it's not, the idea of rest wasn't what we think of as necessarily like catching up on sleep or having a nap or chillaxing or something like that. It was very different. And rest was something that a god would do only in a temple when a crisis had been resolved or when stability had been achieved. So when things had settled down. So one ancient Near Eastern scholar, who's not talking about Israel here, but is talking about the surrounding nation, says this: though the concept of relaxation or even indolence is not lacking, rest concerns most importantly the achievement of stability, security, and order. The deity can rest in his or her temple because the threat of chaos has been dispelled. The deity then takes his or her place in the ordered, controlled cosmos with the leisure of enjoying his or her estate. So deities rest because enemies have been put down. And there's peace, there's stability, there's normalcy, there's order. And so I just want to give a few examples of this from the ancient world. This is it's called the Temple Hymn of Kesh, which is one of this, and then some other document are actually the two oldest. This is one of the two oldest surviving pieces of literature we have in the world, and it's a Sumerian account of the creation of man and woman, and it connects it with the creation of a temple, and this time it's the temple of a god named Nintud, and it's written by this guy Kesh. This guy he has a hymn to the temple, and he says this. He says, "House inspiring great awe, called with a mighty name, house whose fate is grandly determined by the great mountain, house of the Anua gods possessing great power, which gives wisdom to the people. House reposeful, dwelling of the great gods. House which was planned together with the plans of heaven and earth, with pure divine powers. House which underpins the land and supports the shrine." So if you didn't get all of that, I probably should have put it on a slide. But you can see it speaks of, it's a hymn to a temple, and it calls it a house reposeful dwelling of the great gods. A reposeful dwelling, it's a place of rest. But it's also a place where gods rule. It was, and they rule with what it says, pure divine power, and they underpin the land and support the shrine. And they say the temple was patterned off of the nature of the universe, and that it came about with the creation of the world. It says, possessing great power, reposeful. It does say that there. I forgot where I put it. But this is one example. There's another famous Babylonian creation story called the Enuma Elish, and it talks about this guy Marduk. We'll talk about it a little bit later. And after he establishes peace, he's allowed to call his temple the chamber that shall be our stopping place. And then he has other things that he says about it. And then you can see this as well with the account of David in the Old Testament. David is not a god in the Old Testament, but he's a king. And after he brings peace and order and stability to the people of Israel, it says this in 2 Samuel. "Now it came about when King David lived in his house, and the Lord had given him rest on every side from all his enemies." And the idea isn't just that he can rest, he can stop working. Now that the enemies have been subdued, and there's stability and normalcy, David can go about running his kingdom, right? He can care for his people, take care of kind of the regular day-in, day-out events without having to worry about the threat coming from outside. So deities in the ancient Near East rest in temples and only after order is established. And one way that I thought about this, I think the metaphor breaks down fairly quickly, so don't push it too hard. But for us, when we think about our who's in control of this country, we probably think of Wall Street first, but we should think of like the White House, the center of power. And where is the president's authority exercised? And we think of it as in the Oval Office, right? The place where he goes about his day-in, day-out business, all that kind of stuff. But in the ancient world, it would be slightly different. They would think of the Lincoln bedroom more as the place where he rests, right? Because problems have been resolved, which isn't always the case, but in our country. So before kind of looking at Genesis, I want to say, kind of summarize what we've said. We've covered a lot of track. It's sort of weird, old, ancient stuff. but you signed up for that. You knew it was on. It said ancient in the title. You have yourself to blame. But so in the ancient world, any talk of creation would most certainly bring to mind the reality of a temple. The cosmos and the temple were overlapping and interlinking realities. Temples were a major part of life and also held deep imaginative connections and reminders of how people were to understand the cosmos in which they lived and over which their god ruled. And so through these sort of subtle literary allusions in Genesis 1, there are these echoes of temple-making imagery that were, I think, probably doubtlessly obvious to people, the first hearers of this, but to us are completely missed. So Israel has offered the world her own radically unique take on the way the cosmos was meant to be. And it's this, that Genesis is a story about a creator God who's created his world where there was original order, peace, and goodness. And he's placed humanity, men and women alike, as his idol, as his image, within it to mediate his presence to all of his creation, which is itself his home, his sacred place of rule and rest. And this is how the story begins. And I want to go back to this quote from McIntyre. I can only answer the question of what I am to do if I can answer the prior question of what stories or stories do I find myself a part of. And this is a story of a God who made a world of order, a world where there was original peace, a world that is good, and a world that he wants to dwell in, that is his sacred special place. So I want to draw three kind of broad implications from what this story is saying, especially trying to be aware of the fact that there are many other stories, ancient and modern, old and new, that are sort of competing with this story to tell us about ourselves. And I want to say, what does this text tell us about the world? Sort of given away from the title of the lecture. What does it tell us about ourselves? And what does it tell us about God? So significantly, if you know Genesis 1, it begins by saying, in the beginning, God created heavens and the earth. And in our mind, heavens and earth are sort of two separate realities that are sealed off from one another. They speak of two different realms of reality. But to the ancient mind, heaven and earth was just a shorthand way of saying everything that is. Like, if there is something, it's heavens and earth. It's everything, everything. It's an all-inclusive statement. And so what it's saying is that all of this, God, all that there is, God has made and God cares about. Isaiah picks up on this. It's not just that God cares about this. It's God's temple. It's God's place of dwelling. It says, heaven is my throne and the earth my footstool. Where is the house you will build for me? This is Yahweh. This is the God of Israel speaking. Where will my resting place be? Has not my hand made all these things? And so they came. They came into being. And so the idea is just, you know, in the ancient, we don't really have temples around us as much. But the idea was that a God could be encountered or found in their temple. So part of what Genesis is getting at here is the original intent is God can be found and related to in his world, not just in one specific place after certain sort of divinations and mysterious rituals have been performed, but that God is to be found. And God wants to be found. God wants to dwell with his creation. So, and not only this, God cares deeply about his creation. I think often our theology, our spirituality can kind of blissfully glide over the day-in, day-out realities and concerns for the material and environmental well-being of this world. And if they have, it's probably because our faith hasn't been adequately informed by the story that Genesis 1 is telling, that the world matters to God, that matter matters to God, that God cares for the earth and the air, the trees and the sea, the soil and the wildlife. God cares for the sun and the moon, the stars and the planet. God cares for the whole world. And of course, God cares for his people. There's a special place for God's people in this world, and we're going to get to that. But God is also concerned with environmental degradation, global warming, deforestation, oil sands, all of the things that pollute and ruin his temple. So the kind of neat and tidy sacred-secular divide that the church has operated in for the last few hundred years and has really haunted us, and as well as tendencies within almost the whole Christian tradition to elevate the spiritual over the material, none of that finds any justification or grounding in the story of Genesis 1. Genesis 1 is saying that matters. I thought that would come off a lot smoother and easier than it did. Because it matters to God, because he's made it to be a place where he can dwell, where he can rest. There's so much more we could say about that, but we're going to move on. And so secondly, I want to say, who are we? What does this story tell us about who we are in our day-in, day-out lives, in our jobs, in maybe our unemployment, in our frustrations, in our happiness? What does this say about us, that human beings were made in the image of God, especially if we read Genesis 1 as this story of a temple, a temple being built that he wants to come and reside in? And much of the discussion about what it means to be made in the image of God has dwelt on the non-material, kind of non-physical parts of who we are. Because so whether it's our rationality, the fact that we can relate to one another, the fact that we can forgive, that we can love, all of these things are things we've talked about because we've been asking questions about, we're made in the image of God, we're different than the rest of creation. And I think all of those things are true and they're components of the image of God. I don't want to throw them away. It's just that sometimes these things tend to reinforce another nagging hiccup in the, I said hiccup twice there, I kind of hiccuped on my hiccup, in the Christian tradition, which has been a dualistic understanding of the human person. That somehow the material plays a secondary role to the non-material. It's the spiritual part of us that matters. It's the rational part of us that matters. It's not the material part of us that matters. But if we read Genesis 1 as a story with these temple connotations, and knowing that temples in the ancient Near East were places where deities would place their idols that were modeled after them, I think there's something we can pick up on. In fact, the Hebrew word, which is commonly translated as image, typically and legitimately within its semantic range of possibilities, includes the word idol, which is by its very nature a localized, visible, corporal representation or manifestation of the divinity's presence. So it's material and it's spiritual at the same time. Its materiality is not getting in the way of its spirituality. In fact, if it wasn't material, it couldn't manifest the presence of the deity in the temple. So there's this sort of priestly connotation to being human. We're embodied, right? We're material things. We're made to represent and manifest God in his cosmic temple. And it's both men and women, the human person. We saw the picture of kings before. Kings were considered divine, made somehow in the image of God, and kind of no one else was. But the story that Genesis 1 tells is that male and female, rich or poor, all people are made in the image of God and function as God's idol or God's image. They mediate his presence in the world. And so, and maybe if we're uncomfortable with talking about using the word idol in that way, which I kind of am a little bit myself, just because it's a word with negative connotations, but I think it's informative. But we think about where that comes in the story, that we're told we're made in God's image. God has just been working. God has been doing work. He's been kind of using his hands, in a sense. He's created his temple, and he wants to take place in it. And so finally, I just want to talk about who is God, if this story is true. Who is the God that's presented in this story. And I've highlighted that there's sort of a common understanding of temples, and there's shared realities in the ancient world across cultural divides. But really, the story of Genesis 1 is radically distinct and radically unique in the ancient world. It was like a bombshell that dropped off. And one of the main reasons was it presents one God who made the world, who made everything in it. There's one God. There's just one God, and he made it with his power. So throughout the ancient Near East, the creation of the world and human history was seen as the result of a battle between contentious and violent deities. And so from the start, there was violence and chaos. So kind of when you get to the heart of the matter behind everything, what's true about the world, what's true about us, what's true about God, what's true about everything, is violence and self-interest, right? That we're doing things for ourselves. These are the gods who made the world. We're not really any different than them. We're less than them. So at the heart of these stories is violence and self-interest. It sounds like postmodern nihilism in lots of ways. There's connection. And so one example of what this looks like, I mentioned before Enuma Elish, and there's God Marduk, and he's the god who creates the world. And this is how he does it. He murders another god, a goddess named Tiamat, and then with her corpse makes the world. So that's the world we live in. One god, one male god killed a female goddess and used her corpse and made the world. That's where the world comes from. And so in that story, and in other ancient Near Eastern accounts, all that is the result of cosmic rivalry and violence. The gods are at war with one another. The world is chaos. And that's the chaos that whichever the strongest god would win at would then be able to find rest. But Genesis 1, there's no war. There's no violence. There's no rivalry. There's just God. And God is presented as a craftsman who alone creates because he alone has power. And he creates a world that at the heart of the world, if you go all the way back to what's natural, is order. Think about, this is, Sandy Richter in her book has a much better chart, but this is the only chart I could find. But the story of Genesis is God forming creation. He's separating things. He's making space the first 3 days. And then the next three days, 4 to 6, he's filling those spaces with things. And there's order, there's symmetry, and there's peace, right? Because God calls the world good. He delights in the world, and he enjoys the world. And so the word that's used for good in Genesis 1 is this word tov, and it's a word that has a lot of aesthetic connotations. It's a very sensory word. This word that God feels towards the creation he's made, this ordered creation where there's original peace. This word tov throughout the rest of the Old Testament is used to describe bread and wine and honey and lotion, a feast, shade under a tree on a hot day. And so this is what God feels. Those are the sort of things God feels towards the world he's made. Tim Keller, or Timothy Keller, in his really helpful book on work, says this: creation is not the aftermath. Is not the aftermath of a battle, but the plan of a craftsman. God made the world not as a warrior who digs a trench, but as an artist. Not as a warrior digs a trench, but as an artist makes a masterpiece. And there's order going back to here. But where Sandy Richter's chart is a little more helpful is it shows that there's a movement throughout these days to the seventh day, the day where God finds rest. And the content and the structure of Genesis 1 point to the seventh day as the climax of the story. So we know that it's centered around 7 days, we know that, but there's other ways that are less obvious to us on our first read where this number 7 kind of strangely dominates the opening chapter. So Genesis 1:1 in Hebrew has 7 words. And Genesis 1:2 has 14 words. which is 7 times 2. And many other significant words appear throughout in multiples of 7. So God appears 35 times, Earth appears 21 times, the heavens or the firmament, the idea of sky, appears 21 times, and it was so appears 7 times, God saw it was good 7 times. And then Genesis 2, 1-3, which is talking about the seventh day, makes a reference to the seventh day 3 times in 3 separate sentences, which are all composed of 7 words. Now, people do all sorts of funny things with the number 7, but what I want to say is that there's like a subtle way where the form of Genesis 1 draws the attention of an attentive reader, especially an attentive reader who could read Hebrew, which I can't. Someone else has pulled these out for me. But it draws our attention to the unique and exalted status of the seventh day, that this is what the whole story has been leading to, that it leads to where God finds rest in his temple. The God who acted alone, out of power, who spoke the words, who spoke the world into being, who gave it order, who called it good, who delights in it, is at rest. And it's not a rest that's sleeping or taking the day off. It's the rest that's ruling. And I think what's very significant about having that be the climax of the story, that God is in control, that God exercises his authority over his cosmic temple, which is the world, because once you get into Genesis 2 and Genesis 3 and the rest of the story, and you live in this world, it's sort of hard to really believe that. You know, a lot of things point in the opposite direction. The world is marked by chaos and violence. The world maybe makes more sense as a world that's described by Marduk slaying Tiamat and making the world out of her dead corpse. It's a world where there's violence and self-interest that runs deep. But at the end of the beginning of the story, there is a story where God is in control. God is ruling over his cosmic temple. And significantly, if we go to the very end of the story, the very end of the biblical story, to Revelation chapter 21, temple imagery comes right back in again. The story kind of culminates with this new heavens and this new earth coming down. I see people reading this. I'll let you read it just yet. But this God who desired to dwell with his people, to meet them in his holy temple, which is the world, pursues them. And he pursues them throughout the rest of the scripture, and he wants to be made known. And the story ends like this. This is John speaking. He said, "Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and there was no longer any sea. I saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride, beautifully dressed for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, 'Look, God's dwelling place is now among the people, and he will dwell with them. And they will be his people, and God himself will be with them and be their God.'" And it goes on to say, "He will wipe away every tear from their eyes. There will be no more death or mourning or crying or pain." Then we skip further down, and then John describes the city. He said, "The city was laid out like a square, as long as it was wide." He measured the city, the angel measures the city for John, with a rod, and found it to be 12,000 stadia in length, and as wide as it was long. So that's 12,000 stadia is about 1,400 miles. And he's describing something that's, what's coming down out of heaven is a perfect square. It's a perfect cube. And if any of you were paying attention and remember way back here, the Holy of Holies is a perfect square. And this was a place where one priest could go in one day a year and not see anything. Right? And it's where God's presence was. And the end of the story is that God is going to make the whole world his holy place. A place where he can be found, where he can be known. And significantly, this 12,000 stadia, this 1,400 miles, kind of square miles, To the ancient, I mean, that's about the size of Europe in some way, in Europe. And to the ancient mind, that was the whole world. So there's the temple that's like, I mean, he's speaking hyperbolically here. This square that's coming down is so big you can't imagine it. But it's going to encompass the known world. So Genesis 1, I think, is a story about the world being God's temple. It's filled with these temple allusions that aren't apparent to us on first read, but to ancient eyes would jump out at them, right? 7-day period, God finding rest. Where do God rest? Where do gods rest? They rest in their temples. And I think that will be a good place to stop and take some questions. We need to get some water.
So Josh, to thank you, I'm Lynn Bayer from Trinity Church up in Bolton.
Okay.
And so I'm fairly familiar with John Walton, have not read the other scholars. So this question is more oriented toward my understanding of Walton.
Yeah, sure.
But Walton makes the interesting claim that Genesis 1 is really not about the physical creation.
Right, it's functional.
The ordering and the assignment of purpose to the physical creation.
Yeah.
And he sort of contrasts it with house building and homemaking.
Yeah.
And he says, you know, God built the house and made the home. And there are many revelations in Scripture about his house building. But Genesis 1 is really about his homemaking.
Yeah.
And I was just wondering if you could comment.
Yeah, I think it's helpful. I think the distinction, in fact, it was somewhere in those notes. I guess I just didn't say it. but one of the, he gives, I heard him speak, and he gives an example that I thought was helpful with kind of the home, whether what we're interested in here is a kind of construction, a construction story, a house story, or whether it's a home story where someone has come to dwell and given a certain space significance. He talks about if you were given tickets to go see some traveling Broadway play that you would really love to see. I don't know if you've heard him say this or not. You'd love to see it. It's a once in a lifetime thing. You'd never afford the tickets otherwise. And you drive there, and there's traffic, and there's an accident, and then you get to the theater late. It's hard to find parking, and you look at your ticket, and your ticket is like front row center. So you're like, oh, great. And the play's already started. Things are going on. And so you obnoxiously walk down the aisle with the flashlight, and, you know, people look, and I'm like, oh, who's this, you know, joker who can't be on time? And then you have to walk in front of all the people and find your seat and sit down. And you would ask, you know, if you would ask, like, what did I miss? Like, what's going on? Like what's going on? And what you want, and the person next to you responds with, well, this theater was designed by an architectural firm in St. Louis, and the original construction crew, they had to demolish, and then, you know, he goes on to all these things. That's not the story you need to hear to help you get by. It's an important story. It's a story for another time, perhaps. But what you want to hear is what's gone on in the play. Like, what have you missed? How can I kind of make sense and get my bearings for what's going on? And I avoided using Walton's kind of functional versus material, partly because I think it's really helpful, but I just felt like maybe that's beyond me to talk about. And so I'd like to get my head around it a little bit more. That was a little inside baseball, if that made no sense to you. I like what he says, that the story, like, it's not as though, he's not saying, like, God didn't make the world. It's all over the scriptures. But the way Genesis 1 is set up is it's not trying to tell you that. It's not telling you the construction story. It's telling you how this is a homemaking story. How this world has significance and purpose, and then also who we are, who God is, So, I don't know. Do you want to say anything back to that?
I was just going to say, if it's not a construction story, if it's a homemaking story, then it certainly opens up some great possibilities for disentangling whether they're collisions of claims of faith with claims of science.
Mm-hmm.
That's a very interesting thing to explore.
Yeah. And I think there's definitely places where faith and science collide, but they're more on, how would I say this? They're more on like what kind of questions, like what or why questions, as opposed to how questions. Like, I just don't think Genesis 1 is telling us kind of how exactly everything came to be, but it's telling us like what is it, and what are you, and who are you, and who is this God? I don't think that you read Genesis 2 and the order is all turned on its head. You know, all of a sudden things are different. People are around before there's vegetation, and there's other differences that are eluding me at the moment. But yeah, so it's trying to say, what type of story is this thing? Yeah. I don't know. If you want to say anything else, or...
The other thing is, it opens up possibilities for a disentangling science, but you also realize, gee, if I've been reading this story all these years, it's a different story. And I'm going to go back in there and really learn the story, because there's something happening here that's very important that's other than the construction story.
Yeah.
And that's a whole other very interesting explanation.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, thank you for bringing that in. Yes, yes.
Yeah, I thought it was two sides, and I'm sort of nervous about separating them very much. You know, I think that what you pointed out is really valuable, and is the purpose of the meaning is loaded. And it seems to me if we make it all one or all the other, we'll have to lose something.
Yeah, I think I would... So, go ahead, sorry.
Yeah, so often, who is God throughout the Bible? He's the creator.
Mm-hmm.
He really made this world.
Yeah.
Everyone walking on it, he made it.
Yeah.
And so, in a sense, the home story depends on the construction story to some degree.
Yeah.
Without having to try to make the Genesis 1 and 2 answer our 21st century scientific questions.
Which I don't think it does.
Hopeless task.
But I agree that it's important to hold both. I just think it's which one is it sort of telling here?
Because
it seems, especially when, like you said, it's unambiguous throughout the Hebrew Scriptures. Like, the world was made by God, and the world is under God's command. Like, God is in control. But
I just don't want to change that from Genesis 1, even though the main force is.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's affirming that I think it's more telling of a. It's less telling of how, and more of a what. I still think that God made it. is still very much there. Yeah. Yeah, Thomas.
I think that you brought out that being homely, sorry, or writing is very interesting. I never figured that. And this is not in disagreement with it. But I think I don't have the tape of the name of the man. But there was, I did hear a tape of a man who went through Genesis 1, or Genesis 2. And he really, really dovetailed every single thing perfectly in science, modern science. And I know a lot of people have tried to do that, and I think, well, they're coming close, but it's been really good. But I just lost it.
I think
he really did. I mean, he was amazing.
That's where I
heard anyone else do it and be totally successful.
Yeah, and bye guys. I just wanted to do more of kind of culture, history, text, and not. I mean, like I said in the beginning, like science. There's not sort of one monolithic, unified sort of science out there that's sort of speaking in a unanimous voice, and it's changing. Like, things change a lot.
Science changes.
Sure. I mean, even I mean, just thinking of what I said, like Pluto was a planet when I was a kid, and my children have to grow up in a world where Pluto's not a planet. And, so things, yeah, things change. There's a very strong hand in the back there.
Yeah, I want to go back to some things you're talking about, but I'll make a quick comment on science that I got from MIT today. No, I think it's
I should sit down.
You said science is less a source of authority than it is a successful mode of input. MIT, a guy who lives at MIT, I mean, he's a climate. His point is that cutting edge science is always changing. It's a mode of inquiry. You're asking questions.
It describes. Genesis is not describe. I don't think it's as much describing as it is explaining or giving purpose or intent.
The mode of inquiry is you have questions and you do experiments and you eventually get answers. And stop, you know, certain things have been settled, you know, 100 years ago. Cutting edge science is not an authority. You know, the most recent theory is not an authority. It's just a hypothesis being worked out. Anyway, but I want to get back to your talk on. I think you said some of the other creation stories involve 7 days.
The ceremonies in which an idol was brought
right.
into the temple would happen over 7 days.
Right. And then not just in Hebrew temples.
No, not well. I mean, Hebrew temples didn't have idols.
Good point.
Yeah, yeah. For the Hebrew temple,
because I've often heard said that the Hebrews are the only people that came up with the 7 day. You know, everyone else was on a month basis, and the Hebrews. You know, I don't know if it's true, but I've heard said it's been 7 days.
Yeah, I just. I mean, there's this guy. Like I said, John Walton and Greg Beale have done a tremendous amount of. Kind of cultural excavation in the ancient world and brought these commonalities. I mean, they're not the only ones; they just happen to be the ones that I've read.
Well, what I'm
talking
about is
yeah.
the commonalities versus you said the Hebrew story was a radically different.
Yeah.
And so I'm having trouble with the commonalities and the radical difference.
Well, what I was saying in the beginning and about God accommodating speech, God communicating to us in ways and in forms that we understand, in sort of our conceptual world, in some sense. But what He communicates to us could be radically different from how we've thought about things before. So He's communicating into a cultural moment, sort of patterns of meaning or something where. People think about the world a certain way, and not every culture did the 7 day ceremony with the idol, with all these rituals and divinations that would enliven the idol. But some of them did, and so I think the idea is then the number 7 then is also heard. It kind of reinforces some of the other temple.
Yeah.
Imagery that's in the text that we sort
of.
Does
any of this apply to Aztec, Mayan, Chinese, Cambodian? I'll
come back next term. I don't know. I wanted to situate it in the world that it was first heard. I mean, like Israel spent hundreds of years in slavery in Egypt. Like they were doubtlessly aware of sort of. How that culture thought about certain things. Like, that culture was an influence, and they had neighboring cultures. And so I think there's commonalities about, even amidst the difference of language and whatnot, there was things that people thought about in a similar manner.
Do we know when the Hebrew story was first expressed, even orally?
I think lots of different people have lots of hard evidence that give different opinions, and that's it's out of my league. I do know a lot of people think that Genesis 1 is newer than Genesis 2. I'm not saying that's what I believe. I'm not saying I know how that comes about, but in some sense, it makes some sense to me. But I don't necessarily. It's not that it's not that I don't care or it doesn't matter, because it does matter to some degree, but I just don't know. So I think Ben...
It's just about the commonalities and the differences. It seems that the common language of temple and some of the shared categories of creation stories are used in order to emphasize how different Yahweh is from these other
gods. That's a great way to put it. Yeah.
There's this watery chaos in the beginning of creation, and rather than some epic battle between gods in which there's a victor, God just speaks a word and brings order. And so there's common vocabulary in order to emphasize how different Yahweh is. He's the only one that actually has power. He's the only one that's there, even. And even just the imagery of the temple is obviously an ancient Near Eastern category that people understand. But it's radically so that the Israelites can relate to him, so that, the language they understand. But what's radically different is that there's no idol in the temple. The Holy of Holies is empty. There's the Ark of Covenant, but there's no installation of an idol because human beings were his image on earth. And he is the God that's invisible, and so he can't be represented by some piece of wood. So to me, that's powerful because it's using this common understanding of a temple that is culturally specific that people would understand at the time, but in order to teach them something completely different from all the other cultures.
Thank you. Yeah, that was really helpful, Ben.
Just on following that, strikes me a really important idea because it shames and condemns human making of idols because we're betraying our own identity because we are the image.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it.
And so when we create an idol, we're missing the whole point of who we are ourselves and betraying our whole human identity in doing it. So it's a fascinating connection.
I know I hesitated to even bring up idols just knowing all the work he's done on idols. But yeah.
It's exactly the right thing. And because we are the thing. We are meant to be showing, as you said, presence of God. I have another question, though, that may throw another can of worms. But how do you see in this? I can see how it might be, but where is Jesus at the temple?
Yeah, I mean,
he was a temple. Huge confusion in his ministry and his teaching, what he meant by
that. Yeah,
how do you see as Jesus at the temple?
I'm sorry, what?
Is he not the Word?
The Word? Or I'll just say, I mean, I think you can trace, the reality of the temple in some sense is that it's a place where God can be found, right? Where God dwells. And it's not even just that imagery, like Jesus associates himself very, very unambiguously about it. But like Paul speaks of the church then as the temple, like in Ephesians. And so I think it's something that can be, this guy Beale, who I've mentioned, he traces temple imagery from Genesis all the way to Revelation, and he talks about it as a theology of sort of God's dwelling place. And God's dwelling place, you see the intent in the beginning, that before sin entered the world, before violence entered the world, God's intent was that he could just be found and be in relationship with what he's made. That's compromised, that's ruined, it's compromised, but then God continues to pursue being present to his whole creation, and there's kind of this expanding movement that you can trace throughout the scriptures that culminates with the new heavens and the new earth coming down and being described as the holy, like being characterized as the holy of holies, like, and it's going to cover the whole world. And so you see the intention and the ending as there's a harmony in some sense between them, that they're where it starts is sort of where it's going. So I think yes, Jesus is in the temple. There's tons of meaning there to be brought out, both in his moment, how in Second Temple Judaism understood the temple, understood themselves, but then also that Jesus is where we see God most clearly, and this God who wanted to dwell with his creation in the very beginning, and his creation rebelled against them. He's coming at them again, and this time he's going to make sure that his plan, his intent, will not be thwarted, like in the long run. So I think there's probably more to say, but Marty looks like she's
no.
Oh yeah.
just I think it's really interesting in light of all the stuff you said about the temple and what you just said is the John 4 passage, the discussion that Jesus had with the Samaritan woman, where she goes off on it. Well, you Jews say the temple is here.
Yeah.
We Samaritans say it's over here. And Jesus says, it's not. The true worshippers worship in spirit and truth.
Yeah.
Basically, there's not a holy place anymore.
Or everything is a potential holy place if you just realize it, yeah.
Right. And you look at the contrast between that vision, that biblical vision, and, say, Islam, where there is a holy place, there is a holy language, there is, you know, it's not translatable. It has to be Arabic, and it has to be Mecca, and it has to be, and Jesus is saying, you know, look, true worshipers can worship God anywhere.
Yeah,
and it's not about a physical temple anymore.
I believe you had your hand up, or did you?
Yeah, but you brought out what I was.
Okay, cool. Let's look right here. Yes, sir.
Okay, hi. I'm Richard Schuster. By the way, that photograph is
it's never going to be in a.
I can tell you, it's M31, the Great Galaxy in Andromeda. I'm sorry I didn't point that out before. But I do have another comment to make. Which, if you look at that galaxy, it's interesting to conceive of the placement that the temple has in Jerusalem. Because obviously this galaxy is circular, things go around, the orbit of the Earth goes around the Sun, the Earth itself revolves. Okay, the temple is placed in Jerusalem facing east. It doesn't look back over the city of Jerusalem particularly. It faces east. And in fact, that's the direction that the Earth's rotating. And so the placement of the temple is God wants to face forward. You say that God's Spirit is in the temple. Well, He's going to face forward. The temple front doors go east. And therefore, if you're riding this thing, as God's immutable Spirit must do, He's facing forward. He's looking out east toward where the motion is going. He's not looking out the back window.
And that's very interesting.
East is the direction. We don't want to be facing. Well, I think things have changed a little since then. The dwelling place of God is with men. We're Christians are all the temple of the Holy Spirit.
Amen.
So that's all to be said.
I just back to this question about Jesus. This is just something in thinking about the temple, also thinking about the tabernacle in Exodus and in Leviticus, that there are pieces of that that I think you see Jesus embodied now. So you see, you talked about the menorah, the light. You know, where you have Jesus is described as the light.
This is Walter Kim, right? Yeah. Walter, or not?
It's actually not Walter.
No. But Walter was talking about this after the lecture.
But I think
even
like there was the cistern of water outside, and you had a very similar thing in Exodus in the tabernacle where they came in those water. And with Jesus, you have the new covenant, which is the baptism, right? And the judgment.
From
the judgment of the water. I think, too, Jesus is described as the high priest. So I think there are, again, the Holy of Holies. There's no separation anymore. When he was crucified, when he was torn. And so I think there are also just these pieces that were both reality but also symbol within both the temple and the tabernacle that are used. Jesus is described in different ways that
we're the Walter Kim thing. Walter was, after his lecture, he was talking about how he thinks all of Jesus's I am statements in the Gospel of John have he wonders if they're temple allusions. So where it's clear where Jesus calls himself, associates himself with the temple, but there's also there's also these other. Once you sort of know how the temple works, which I don't really, but or as well as Walter does, but you see that when Jesus is saying those things, he's connecting himself. Like, I am the light of the world. And Peter.
Yeah,
Yeah, I had a question about the sheer time and environment. So obviously now, in the literate age, it's a little bit more obvious how cultural values and categories get, you know, shared and, you know, transported.
Yeah.
In other literature and whatnot, how would that have been done in the ancient era? How would they, I mean, even though obviously, like, Hebrews are, yes, they're living amongst other people, what's, like, the form of communication for the other creation groups such that they would be able to then adopt those same categories?
So, like, how would they know other people's story? Is that what you're,
like, it's obvious if, you know, that I would be able to adopt categories of other cultures down here.
Yeah.
Read them, right? There's a clear path of communication. What's the path of communication in the ancient era?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. I would have to just speculate, but
there were trade routes.
Yeah, and just thinking, temples were not just places. Like I said, they weren't just places of worship. But if you're visiting a place and need really anything, like a temple is a central place. And
would they be able to interpret even like, you know, you enter a temple? Would they be able to, even in the language, be able to see the connection and how the categories are forming based off the architecture of the temple? Or was that just something that people were familiar in? How is that?
Yeah, I mean, I think, the Egyptologist that I quoted before also says, you know, this was not something that, how should I put it? I mean, it's like when I talked about the cross and crucifixion in my previous lecture. Like, I see crosses all over the place. I know what a cross means. I don't stop and think about it. I just kind of know, like, that's what it is. And, like, that this symbol encapsulates the story of one man's life who did not, you know, like, all of the things that the cross symbolizes, a whole story. So I would think that people would clue in on things, but not necessarily, like, every time cognitively recall or deliberately recall, like, these walls are meant to remind me of the primordial oceans that have been separated. Like, but I think at least that's sort of their intent. I mean, I went to church for over a year in a church that was shaped like a cross, and I didn't know. Like, I had no idea that it was shaped like a cross. I mean, some things could be missed, some things could be very apparent. In some ways, I don't know. And then, besides the trade route and the fact that temples were cultural centers, like, there's no word for religion in any of the languages of the ancient Near East. Like, it's, religion is not like something you add on to your everyday life or whatever. It permeates everything. Yeah, everything is. And so I think, you know, to talk about what kind of harvest it was this year, if you're talking with your neighbor who's worshiping some other god, they're going to talk about the like, so-and-so gave me a great harvest. And
we also know from the Old Testament that there was a huge amount of syncretism. The Israelites were worshiping other gods. So the Israelites were worshiping idols, had been fallen into all this.
Because it was probably so unusual and hard to trust a god you couldn't see, you know?
And, I mean, you think of what they, in the beginning, the first few chapters of Deuteronomy, Moses says, anticipates the questions the children are going to ask when they come into the Promised Land. And the questions are all about, why are we so different from everybody that we're living around? Mm-hmm. Why do we have to keep the Sabbath? Why do we have to obey the law? I mean, they were very familiar with what everybody else was doing and not doing, what they were worshiping, and that they were working 7 days a week. And why are we different? And then, tell your children the story of who God is and how you were delivered and why he gave you these good laws that are life-giving and so on. So they were really following us with all the prophets were there to bring them back. And so the point that Ben made and that you've been making is that they were familiar with these stories of the meanings of the temples and different creation stories and the biblical account, used a lot of similar imagery and so on, mm-hmm. but told such a different story.
Yeah.
And one of the main differences being the value of human beings. Absolutely. Human beings were trashed in, you know, mm-hmm. in the Aleisha and other stories. They had no value.
They were
nuisance. The Greeks, the Romans, mm-hmm. you know, the Greek and Roman creation stories,
yeah.
same thing. So some of the categories being similar, and yet the story being so different.
Yeah.
You know, would have or should have brought them back away from their idolatry. I mean, it took God sending the Babylon and Assyria and judging them often to bring them back to Him.
Yeah.
And
so. Yeah. Yes, sir. Oh, or sorry, Peter, did you have another one?
I did, but someone else.
Okay.
I take a restoration view of Genesis 1, and it does connect to the temple concept. In the first verse, God created the heavens and the earth. In the second verse, the world was formless and void. And a lot of scholars, and I agree with the Hebrew behind the word was, that's an arbitrary translation of the word. Better in the context of was, as a lot of scholars say, should became formless and void, into chaos. Okay. Then, but the Spirit is hovering above the waters. The Spirit is going to be bringing order to that chaos. And that's pretty much the whole story that goes from Genesis to Revelations. Adam, as Beale said, Adam is in the Garden of Eden, and by subduing the earth, he has spread that temple throughout the world, bringing order. However, he failed, but the second Adam is now succeeding.
Mm-hmm.
And the Bible ends with the story with the new heaven and the new earth at the end, in which the whole world is a temple again.
Mm-hmm.
So I see Genesis 1 as the restoration of the world from the Holy Spirit, mm-hmm. and we're part of that going on right now.
Yeah.
That's a particular view.
Yeah. It's called rest. I don't know it.
Well, yeah, because I feel.
Yeah. Someone else who hasn't, or Thomas?
Well, I was going to say that what she brought up to me was about the God is a spirit, and they that worship Him must worship Him in spirit and in truth. That was a total departure and change from what I learned before. And I just thought of this now. He revealed this tremendous total departure, tremendous change, not to the Jews, and maybe not even to his disciples, but first to the Jews were in the top, and the Gentiles were lower, and the lowest people of all in the whole world were the Samaritans. And those are the people he revealed that to change.
And to a woman,
no
yeah.
Do we have to be worshiping that temple, which the Samaritans couldn't do anyway.
A woman who had been divorced a bunch of times, yeah.
Total change in the part you revealed to the Samaritans. Mm-hmm. And to a woman who is immoral, for that matter. But the other thing is quite different. I don't want to get into this, but just mention it. It says that the day is 1,000 years, and 1,000 years is a day for the Lord.
Mm-hmm.
1,000 was the biggest number they used back then. Like, it wasn't until the 20th century they didn't even use the word billion, or that, well, after the 20th century. And I don't think the word trillion was in sort of use until our present used it. But anyway, 1,000 was the biggest thing. So what he's saying is a day with the Lord is equal to a time almost understood by man. And so therefore, I thought, and I'm not dogmatic at all, and I argued with my wife about it, not badly argued, she disagreed with it. Somebody said it says a day, and 6 days, that's precisely 6 24-hour periods, not 23 hours and 59 minutes, or 24 hours and 1 minute, exactly 56 times. But to me, I'm not dogmatic about this, but thinking it's going to create the universe in 6 stages, and it could take thousands and thousands and thousands of years in each stage. There's another way to look at it. I'm not being dogmatic to say it's a
Yeah. Yeah. I'm not a creationist in the sense that I believe God made the world in the 6 days as though it's described, but I think in the text, like, of day, like, it means a day, but I'm not, that's just what I'm also not dogmatic and probably not well informed enough about.
Well, if he's bringing order, he can bring order in 720 days.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's no restrictions on it if he's bringing order. If it's homemaking, it can be 7 days by any clock you wish, by your clock, by my clock.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah, I know. So I think I sometimes see an impulse in people to extend, the days to not mean literal days, so that there can be sort of concord between evolutionary accounts of creation and the Genesis one account. And my jury is still out in some sense. I sort of feel like it's forcing Genesis maybe to say something no one would have ever thought that it was saying, perhaps before evolutionary theory. And I don't believe the world was... I'm not a literal seven-day creationist. I think it's just telling a different type of story. Like, it's telling a story about how God has ordered the world, which he's made, and brought it, and made it his home. But I don't know. Sometimes I'm a little suspect when people want to have their kind of reading of the text like radically or just like have no hiccups, I guess, between science and or scientific views of origins. I'm rambling a bit. Did you have your hand up over here? No. Yes.
Well, it's just sort of a thought. So when we're taking the approach to the kind of story that's being told as kind of it's accommodating to the hearer, so that the being understood as categories that are then being used in a different way. Is anyone talking about the fall of man? So maybe in the same sort of way that you may not be a literal seven-day creationist, if you're not a literal seven-day creationist, then it's also pretty hard to not be a literal fall of a first person, right? So what we're not talking about is necessarily science. It's not a scientific account of a fall. So is there a similar kind of storytelling approach that's taking up some sort of category in that narrative as well? Do we have like a... Is there a story that's being entered to talk about like a first sin in the way that we're talking about sort of like a first homemaking? A similar kind of set of narratives that's a part of, or...
Are you outside of Genesis 2 and 3?
Yeah.
Just
in a way that, like, in the way that the creation narrative is kind of appropriating parts of other narratives to tell its own story, is there a sense that narrative is doing the same kind of thing and is not trying to give us what sometimes the tradition has passed down as like a blood inheritance of sin that's passed on from person to person from the blood of Adam, but is instead trying to do a different kind of narrative?
Sorry, if I could just comment on that briefly and then...
Sure, yeah, of course.
But so, some of you, it might... So in 2009, John Walton came out with The Lost World of Genesis 1. And just this past February, he came out with The Lost World of Adam and Eve. And he sort of finishes treating Genesis 2 and 3 in a similar treatment of Genesis 1. And he gets help from N.T. Wright to connect that all in with Romans. And so I would just recommend that as a good read. I'm not sure it will address directly your question, but he goes and treats all of that. And I'm not sure whether he actually touches there on it or not, but the Eastern faith, the Orthodox faith, looks at the fall a little differently. We look at it as a fall. They look at it as a failure to thrive or a misfire on bringing order, a stalling out of the bringing order that needed to then be corrected. you know, by Jesus. So it's all very interesting. I just want to comment.
Yeah, and he just in that book, he would say that there was. I mean, because he's dealing with Genesis 1, and then he's looking at Genesis 2 and 3, which are, I mean, have a very different feel. Like I even sort of said before, there's sort of inconsistencies. So humanity comes last in Genesis 1. Humanity's there in the like very beginning. Humanity is, humans are spoken. God speaks and they're made in Genesis 1. In Genesis 2, he forms them from the dust and then breathes life into them. So, I mean, I think as a whole, they kind of all need to be read together. I'm not sure this is exactly what your question is, but I'm just going to keep talking for a moment. what he says is that the way that the text would be read is that Adam was a real person. Whether or not he was the first person, he would say most likely not, but that he was a representative person. He is kind of an archetypal person. He stood for all of humanity. And exactly how, so there was that sort of first act of disobedience. There was that first sin. How that then there spreads to the rest of humanity is something that Genesis doesn't talk about. Paul talks about it. but clearly, I mean, the consequences of that one act are cosmic. Like it affects the whole world. So it is a real Adam with a real fall, but it's not as like he's a representative human being amongst probably many other people. It wasn't just there are two people; they both sinned, you know. But it's a little more complicated than that as well. But I mean, I think if there's other stories that speak about a fall, and I'm not an expert, but it seems as though there's no fall in other stories because there never was a state of goodness. Like, there never was a state of peace that came before these things. Like, the world has just always been competition, rivalry, violence, and that's all that there ever was. So that's where I think one of what...
So it's like relocating the place of or origin of disorder.
Yeah, and saying that the world that God made is the way we understand our God is a God who made this world good, not a God who is kind of petty and revengeful, and he's different than us, and he's made this world good. So maybe don't quote me on that, but or quote me on that. Yeah. You should put it on a T-shirt. Thank you for coming. Yeah, I think that's one of the big distinctions is that there is some sort of there is a fall, there is a ruin of something that there's a soiling of something that was good.
References to a non-ancient Near East or Western culture here?
No, I'm kidding. Yeah, of course.
Your name?
Yeah.
All right. Okay, in Southeast Asia, there are a people group called I think I can pronounce this, the Haren people. Have you heard of these guys? Well, they I believe are mostly found in the mountainous regions of Myanmar. Okay, and so they were, you know, a pretty obscure people group. They were away from the coastline. They didn't have contact with Westerners until not so terribly long ago. And it was quite some time before Westerners understood their traditional belief. They had an interesting traditional belief. They believed that their ancestors had once been good but then had gone wrong, and that they were then forced into a place of exile because of the misdeeds of their ancestors. And they were treating the world as being a place of bad fortune to them because their ancestors had done these wrong things.
Mm-hmm.
And so when they first were told the Christian gospel, they said, oh, well, that's it. And so this people group has very largely, to a large extent, become Christian because their ancient, most deeply held cultural beliefs were a story which really resonated with the fall of Adam and Eve, as told in the Bible. And they said, wow, you know. And we had, or an interesting thing was, they also had an ancient story which said that a person with light skin would bring them a book that would tell them more about